This is
Stan Z Perspectives.
Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Stan Z Perspectives. I'm Daniel Tu, one of your hosts for today. I'm a junior in high school and my main scientific interests are in biology and chemistry, and I have a particular interest in medicine.
And I'm your co-host, Evan Liu. I'm also a junior in high school and I'm interested in biology and public health.
In today's episode, we have the amazing opportunity to be joined by Jonathan Chernoff. Dr. Chernoff has had a very prestigious career at the Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia.
He'll be telling us about his day-to-day work and what being a professional researcher and leading a lab involves.
And now let's turn to our guest, Dr. Chernoff. Hello, Dr. Chernoff. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Dan and Evan. Nice to meet the two of you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being up with us today.
Heading right to the start, could you just take us back to the very beginning? When and how did you first discover your interest in biology and cancer research?
Well, that does go back quite a ways now. You know, I grew up in a family of six kids. My dad was a physician, and he had kind of an interesting career. He was a general practitioner, a GP, which is something you don't see much anymore. He did house calls, which is something you really don't see anymore. So, you know, he was out on the road actually seeing patients in their homes when we were kids. And sometimes he'd take us along if it was early evening. And you got quite a view of what, you know, medicine could be like. I mean, you really, in that setting, people really got to know their patients and, you know, in their own homes, you knew their families, their kids, what kind of situation they were living in. And there were a lot, you know, it was a very kind of romantic era of medicine that doesn't exist anymore, but it did impress me on, first of all, how respected and beloved my dad was by his patients and the good things that he could do for them, even with the limited toolkit that we had back, you know, in the 60s and 70s. So I had a very positive view of medicine, although I also saw there was a lot of things that needed improvement and lots of diseases that we couldn't impact on. And I got interested in particular in cancer. My dad was more interested in heart disease, but you know, through college, I knew that I wanted to do something in that space. And for the longest time, I couldn't decide whether I wanted to be a doc, you know, like my dad had been, or a scientist. And I kept flip-flopping back and forth as an undergraduate eventually learned that you could do both, that they had things called MD-PhD programs. And I ended up going to one at Mount Sinai, MSTP, which was Medical Scientist Training Program, a federal program that had been set up for really for people like me who had interest in both camps. And I kept delaying, you know, the ultimate decision, should I be a doctor or a scientist? For the longest time, I ended up getting the double degree. Then I did a residency in medicine, a full, you know, 3-year gig. And then I did a fellowship in oncology, and then I did a postdoc after that. And so it wasn't really until I was in my mid-30s when I figured out that I wanted to be a, you know, real medical scientist. I was going to still see some patients when I could, but I'd primarily be lab-based. And that's when I started at Fox Chase in the early 90s, and I've been there ever since. I'm now the director of the place, but I maintain a laboratory like I've always had and, you know, still do research as well as direct the institute.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you mentioned that your father, he took you with him on it during his work. And I'm just wondering, do you think there's a very big difference in how healthcare is administered back when you were visiting with your father and now, like, and how do you think?
Night and day. Now, some things for the better. I mean, if you were to look back at how medicine was done back then, for all the virtues of seeing patients in their homes, it was pretty inefficient. I mean, you had to drive someplace, you saw a patient, you know, it might take hours before you were done with a single person. Seeing somebody in a clinic setup, you know, the throughput, as they say, in the business world is far higher. So I think, you know, you gain something, you lose something. From the patient's perspective, it's much less pleasant to have to go to some sterile environment and, you know, be crammed into a 10-minute appointment, you know, after waiting for hours. But probably you couldn't do medicine today the way that it was done back then. It was just a much different era. In fact, some of it was even before Medicare and Medicaid. So patients often paid in kind, which is kind of a strange concept to think about now, but we would get, sometimes my dad would be paid, you know, in lasagna and rather than in money, because that's what the patient would have. And, you know, there are all kinds of, you know, you took care of people and, you know, they paid what they could basically, but, you know, those days are long gone. And, you know, I do think it severed an important connection to patients, but was probably inevitable. There's really no place in the world that does it, you know, the way it was done back then. Plus technology is so different now. I mean, you could say that there's a somewhat return to those days. And now that we're in the era of telemedicine, so you actually can see a patient in their home, so to speak, through a computer screen like we're doing here. It's not quite the same, but maybe it's as good as we can do today.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you so much for elaborating on that. And you've lived all around the country while pursuing education. You had undergrad at Yale, the MD, PhD you mentioned at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City, residency in Pittsburgh, and a clinical fellowship at Johns Hopkins, and then finally a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard. Which stage of your education did you find the most influential?
You know, I've thought about that over the years, because I've been to a lot of great institutions. I mean, you're talking about Harvard, Yale, Hopkins, et cetera. I would say it was still college. You know, it's funny to think with all these advanced degrees and, you know, specialized training, but college at Yale, you know, was a fantastic institution with so many talented people from all walks of life. And so, although I was pre-med, I took a lot of history courses, English courses, you know, other languages, sociology. And you just, the common denominator was everybody was phenomenally smart and talented in something. And I think as you become more specialized, you go to medical school, grad school, law school, whatever your thing may be, you're still dealing with smart people, but now they're more restricted in what their interests are. So when you go to med school, people are spending full time, you know, learning anatomy and learning cell biology and the things you need to know to become a doctor. They're not talking so much about politics or history, et cetera. So I found that the undergraduate environment was the most interesting for me. And to this day, there's still some people from that time that I'm closer to than perhaps some people I met later on. So I really enjoy going back to my college reunions, things like that, just to see what these phenomenally talented group of people have done with their lives.
Even at Yale, or maybe even before that in high school, did you start to get involved in scientific research? Like, I know you mentioned going around with your dad to house calls, but did you like start to get involved yourself, like doing science projects here and there?
Not so much in high school. I went to a pretty gritty inner city high school in New Haven, Connecticut, where I grew up, which I ended up leaving. I graduated after 3 years. I never was a senior in high school. And that was, it was just New Haven at that time in the 70s was in a bad place, and the school itself was a very unsafe environment. So I kind of didn't do much science things. I was just studying as hard as I could, getting good grades and kind of getting out early, which was possible to do. And I went to Yale after that, so I stayed in the same city. When I got to college, I had now a little bit more latitude with my time, and I started doing research. I think it was my second year. I took a course in molecular biophysics, and the professor, I remember going to see him, could I work for him in the summer? He had some projects I was interested in. That would have been my first research project. And he said, we'll see. And what he meant is, we'll see what kind of grade you get in my course. So I studied as hard as I could. I got an A. It later turned out that that guy was one of my father's patients, as many people in New Haven were. He probably would have taken me anyway, but I didn't know that at the time. And I did, you know, the best job I could. He did hire me. So I had my first experience in college in a lab. And it was, you know, serious work. It was a project I still remember to this day. It actually set me on the course that I'm on this day in an area called signal transduction. And so I got a great experience in that lab, and, you know, is foundational to everything I did ever since.
And then obviously you were really split between like the MD versus PhD path, even down to like with the fellowships, doing both like a clinical one and then like a postdoctoral research one. So like, when did you tell yourself, okay, I'm going to follow the research path of a scientist over the, say, like a clinical care path of a
physician? Really after I arrived at Fox Chase. So I started there in the early 90s, you know, I was actually the only person ever put in both the medical and the research divisions. There were separate divisions back then. And so usually you went into one or the other. I was in both. And for about 4 or 5 years at the start of my career, I stayed in both. But I found that seeing patients and doing research weren't compatible for me at the same doing the same at the same time. The reason for that was I was so interested in the research part that I felt I was beginning to shortchange my patients. In other words, you know, you have a patient comes in, they have to take first priority. You know, whatever you're doing in the lab doesn't matter if somebody's having, you know, bleeding or anemic or, you know, has a fever, you have to take care of that. And if you're distracted by something else, you know, I think you have to have some self-reflection about whether you're doing the right thing. So I never neglected my patients, but I got to the point where I was afraid I might start doing that. And so I somewhat reluctantly gave up seeing patients. In part, it was also due to changes in how medicine is administered. So back in the day, the hospital which we have at Fox Chase would have attendings each month that were called ward attendings. So this meant that someone like myself could take care of, be responsible for all the patients on a given ward in the hospital for the month of, say, July. And the next month, someone else would be ward attending. That way I could restrict my medical activities to 1 month a year, which I could handle. Somewhere in the mid 90s, there was a change in how that's done at most hospitals where they now hired professionals called hospitalists. So hospitalists are specialists who take care of inpatients. And so Fox Chase didn't need me anymore to be a ward attending because they had people they paid, you know, to do that full time. And so with that change, plus my own realization that I was really more of a lab person, that's where I can make more of a difference. You know, I started thinking about that. Plus, you know, one of the differences between doing medicine and doing research, in research, you can always see your progress over time. So if you take, you know, a year, January 1, and then you go to December 31 of that same year, you can look back and say, what did I do over that year? And you see a line. It's hopefully a rising line, not a flat line or a descending line, but you can see progress. And over longer periods of time, you see even more progress. In medicine, it's a little different because you might fix one patient's problem, but then another patient comes in with the exact same problem or something even worse. So you're kind of, I felt on a treadmill a little bit. And I just really liked seeing building things. And I wasn't getting that sense out of doing clinical medicine. So it was a very personal decision. I think there are plenty of physicians who get a lot of satisfaction out of their careers in seeing patients. It's just, I had something even more compelling. And so I chose that path.
Right. So in 1991, you come to the Fox Chase Center here at Temple as an associate member. And at that point, it's been around for almost two decades. You know, it was founded after the merger of a cancer hospital and a cancer research institute. But like, obviously it wasn't to the level that it is today. So what motivated you to make the move here? And like, why were you drawn here specifically?
Well, so I'm going to correct your history a little bit. So you're right about the facts you said, but there's some additional ones that might make it easier to understand. So the Fox Chase Cancer Center was formed in 1974, as you indicated, but the two predecessor institutions which joined to make up Fox Chase both had much longer history. So the science part was the Institute for Cancer Research. And the research, the clinical part was the American Oncologic Hospital. So American Oncologic started in 1904, and the Institute for Cancer Research is 1927, I believe, somewhere thereabouts. So the ICR, or Institute for Cancer Research part, had a very prestigious history. So it had what I sometimes call the murderer's row of scientists. That's an old baseball term, but the it had two Nobel Prize winners, Barry Blumberg, Ernie Rose. It had many people in the National Academy of Science, a lot of very famous scientists there. So by the time I got there, it was a powerhouse scientifically. Many of those original, you know, murderer's row people were still around when I joined. In fact, they were some of the people that hired me. So there was just phenomenal talent. Hospital also had some great people. I wasn't as concerned with them at the time, but they had some very fine physicians, surgeons, people in population science, also quite well renowned. So the institution, although small, was extremely prestigious. And I had offers to stay up in Boston at Harvard. I had offers at other places. And initially I had thought more about staying up in Boston. But the more I visited Fox Chase, and it took me three visits in total before I made up my mind, the more convinced I was that this was really the place for me. It had a very unusual environment, and you had these world-class scientist. I mean, you can't get much higher than winning Nobel Prizes, and we had two of them. But also a certain humility, which I found lacking at Harvard. I mean, it's not true of every individual, but in aggregate, you know, when I first came to Fox Chase, the guy who was probably most influential was named Al Knudsen. He's he was the discoverer of something called the two-hit theory. He's a very famous guy. He probably should have won the Nobel Prize himself, but he was a Lasker Prize winner anyway, which is about as close as you can come. And Al Knudsen, he was like insisted on carrying my bags, which I found quite unusual at the time. And plus, we went to his office, and instead of having a big grand office the way you might imagine such a famous scientist to have, he was in a little hole in the wall in the basement with no windows. I said, wow, you know, that was by choice that he had that, but he certainly didn't have as big an ego as one might expect in a person of that level of accomplishment. And that was probably the decisive factor, meeting him and seeing, you know, how humble he could be, despite the fact that he had done such great things, really sold me on the place.
And you mentioned Al Knudsen. Was there one of those great scientists specifically you looked up to as an inspiration or as a mentor?
Well, you know, there's several, but, you know, stylistically, I really admired a guy named Bob Perry. Bob Perry was a National Academy member also, not quite as famous as the other ones, but quite well known. It turned out that I had studied one of Bob's papers when I was still in college. That was when the journal Cell had just started, which is, you know, the most prestigious journal in molecular biology. And I think I was assigned by my professor to review a paper that had been published in the first issue of Cell. And it turned out that Bob Perry was the author of that paper. So I remember when I met him, I said, you know, I reviewed your paper as an undergraduate. And he wanted to see the review, but I didn't keep that assignment, unfortunately. But Bob was really what I think of as a scientist. He was so precise about things. When he would prove something, he would prove it 3-4 different ways. So you came out of reading one of his papers with no doubts that he was right about whatever the topic of that paper was. It wasn't supported by just one pillar. There were four pillars. And he taught me, you know, that whenever you have an important result, you have to support it by more than one line of evidence. And his papers were just absolute models for how you should write a science paper. Basically, the whole story was in figure one, you know, the main story. And then everything else that came after that was those other supporting pillars to make sure that the claims of the first figure were correct. So, you know, he wasn't the most famous, but I think he was sort of the most classic of the scientists. And I really looked up to him, how he did things, and tried to model my own career on his, although I've certainly learned from other great people as well. But it is important to have a mentor. I mean, you mentioned that about just mentors in general. It's good to seek out good mentors during your career. It doesn't have to be just one, but, you know, you look at someone whose career is one that you want to emulate. And if you're lucky enough and they're friendly enough and, you know, they can start advising you on things. They don't even have to be at your own institution, although it definitely helps if they are. And it's not even just at your professional level when you finally get your job. It's along the way, high school, college, you know, graduate school or med school. I mean, in all of those phases, one should seek out mentors, and they can be, some could be colleagues, although they're not going to have the kind of experience that, you know, a mentor who's older would be, but professors or even retired people sometimes. But it's really invaluable to have that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And moving on to the next question, for the last 21 years, you've been researching cancer signaling and epigenetics. Could you break down these terms for us?
Sure. So signaling, it's a little bit like if you, well, maybe it's not so simple anymore, but I used to think of, TVs had antennas and, you know, signals were sent over airwaves. Now they're done through the internet, but signaling is kind of a cell's version of that. There are molecules on the surface of proteins that receive signals from outside, either hormones or other types of signals, oxygen levels, things like that. And then they transmit the signal inside the cell to change the cell's behavior, maybe change its shape, change its motility, change its growth. Like maybe the cell wasn't growing before and the signal says start to grow or die. So there are signals that tell cells to die. So signaling is really basic to any cell's function, any organism's function. And in cancer, it's almost inevitable. It's almost has to be true that signaling has gone awry, because in cancer, you have cells that should not be growing that have got mixed up in their signaling and now start to grow. So you get a mass of cells that shouldn't have been there, or they start to move when they shouldn't have moved. So you get metastasis or invasion of tissues. So to me, signaling is a very central element of cancer biology and well worth a career's worth of study. Now, epigenetics, which is both an old field and a new field in the sense that the term epigenetics and its initial investigations occurred way back in the 1930s and 40s, but has had something of a renaissance more recently. Now, what that's all about is this second layer of genetic control. So we think of mutations, that would be the first layer where changes in the sequence of DNA occur. You know, you go out in the sun, UV radiation from the sun mutates DNA in your skin, you might end up with melanoma or squamous cell cancer. That's genetic changes. Epigenetics is a little different. That's you ate certain kind of foods or exposed to certain environments that didn't change your DNA sequence, but changed how that sequence gets expressed. And although it gets a little complicated, maybe too complicated for this particular discussion, it involves changes that are not heritable the way that DNA mutations are. So you don't necessarily pass them on to the next generation, but you do change how the genes get expressed from that DNA. And the reason I got interested in that with a background in signaling is that's where a lot of signaling terminates. So if you think about the old TV analogy, you have a signal coming, you know, out of the sky or through an internet fiber, reaches your television. Now it gets interpreted into a picture or a show that you're watching. The final element of that, which in the case of TV would be, you know, the pixels changing from green to yellow or blue, might be changing how histones are methylated or how DNA is methylated. And that would change how the DNA gets expressed into RNA and protein. So this epigenetic phenomenon, which has a lot of depth to it, it's quite a large field now, is to me the end of the road or the end of the pathway for signaling. So it starts with some signal from outside the cell and terminates in an epigenetic change. So the two are linked. Epigenetics and signaling are pretty closely linked, with the latter field, the epigenetics, being one that's more recently gotten the attention of scientists. So in the beginning of my career, I didn't think much or talk much about epigenetics. Now it's on my mind quite a bit.
Right. Well, a lot of scientists have, you know, personal connections to the topics they end up studying, especially with cancer, since it impacts so many people. So did you experience the same phenomenon, out of all the research topics, why cancer?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. I mean, some were intellectual, if you will, and some were more personal. You know, at the intellectual level, if you were a medical student and you wanted to, you were thinking about areas where advances were needed, where, you know, there was a lot of territory, let's say. Cancer is a good one to think about, because even today we have a lot of progress needs to get made. And it kind of is an all body phenomenon. You know, cancer affects almost every tissue in the body, so that you're not restricted to studying, say, just the eye or just the kidney, or you're a specialist in those fields. So it allowed me to be more of a generalist. On a more personal level, you know, like many families, maybe almost every family, mine has not been untouched by cancer. My mother developed breast cancer when she was just in her 40s, got cured of that by a surgery, but then got an independent second breast cancer on the other side 10 years later, another surgery. Fortunately for her, she actually survived both of those. And when she died last year at 98, she was cancer-free. So she didn't die of her breast cancer, but she went through pretty horrendous set of treatments back then, because, you know, we didn't know any better. And again, for she had a good outcome in that she survived all that, but these after effects of getting the kind of surgery she got were pretty severe. And it was a personal brush. And then my own sister, more recently, after I was already a professional doing cancer research, died of colon cancer in her 50s. So it certainly has touched my family. And I think if you talk to people, you know, when you're young, maybe less so, your friends, maybe you don't have any who've had cancer, but if you ask about their families, their parents, their uncles, grandparents, you will find, unfortunately, that almost every family has been touched by this.
Yeah. So a lot of times scientists are forced to like specialize in a specific research topic out of necessity, right? Because like you have to choose
Yeah.
something. So like did that happen to you, or was it like just like purely out of interest?
Well, for me, no, I didn't, even now, I don't focus on one particular type of cancer. There are a lot of people who do that. Like they'll be the breast cancer guy or the colon cancer person. I'm a little bit more of a generalist, and that's because I'm more discipline driven. That is, I'm in signaling. That's my scientific discipline. Signaling abnormalities occur in all cancers. Certain pathways that I'm particularly interested apply to many. And so I work on any cancer that has, it's driven by abnormalities and pathways that I'm researching. And so it turns out it's a rather odd collection. I guess from a patient's point of view, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but from a scientific point of view, it does. Diseases like breast cancer are linked to melanoma, are linked to neurofibromatosis in their signaling. They have some similarities, and probably some of the therapies will be similar. But you wouldn't think it when you look at, you know, what the patient has. Somebody has breast cancer, obviously it's not the same as colon cancer, it's not the same as neurofibromatosis at the level of the patient, but the therapies may end up being similar. And so I'm quite interested in that, trying to find things that will work in more than one type of condition.
What is the primary question you seek to answer through your research?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, not completely simple to answer. So in signaling, a lot of times we talk about targeted therapy. That is, the goal of what we do is to find some protein that's driving the cancer process. And then once we identify that, we can make small molecules that ultimately become drugs, inhibitors that, you know, you use, medicines. And that's been done in my field quite a lot. And there's some famous cases. You may have heard of the drug Gleevec, for example. It's a treatment that they give to people with chronic myelogenous leukemia or CML. This used to be a disease that required bone marrow transplant, and even then, that didn't work most of the time. Now people take this pill every day, and they're pretty much okay, and they can go on, you know, until they die of something else in old age, not of leukemia. So that's been an example of a targeted therapy that really, really works. But for most targeted therapies, and I'm in that space a lot, so this is in my expertise area, patients respond and then they develop resistance. So this is kind of a long way around to getting to your question, but I'm interested in mechanisms of drug resistance. Why is it that after we identify at the molecular level the abnormality in a given cancer, and then we go out and with the assistance of the drug companies, come up with a fantastic inhibitor for this thing, and it works great for 3 weeks, and then the cell finds a way around it? Why is that, and what can we do to defeat this? And so that, problem of drug resistance is really consuming me now. We're really looking for not just the primary target, because we've got a lot of them. What are the mechanisms that are used to evade it? Some people call it reprogramming. The cell reprograms itself to get around the blockade. You can think of it, it may be in your own experience, you know, a lot of bacteria become resistant to antibiotics. You know, penicillin used to kill almost all bacteria. Now so many bacteria become resistant. So you could say they've reprogrammed themselves. They found a way around it. But cancer cells do the same with our best targeted agents. And so that's where I'm spending sort of the rest of my career, trying to figure out this issue of drug resistance.
Yeah. What is the single biggest moment in your research career?
There's been a lot of different ones. I think one of the biggest moments occurred pretty early on in my career at Fox Chase when we were looking to clone some new genes and found something that we ended up calling PAC, which is, I have a lot of papers on this, you can see in my CV. But the reason that had such an impact on me is when we cloned that thing, I saw right away that there was a very close, what we call ortholog, something that looked very similar to it in yeast. And although that may seem kind of, you know, who cares, it meant that the signaling that we were seeing in human cells, that since we had the same genes as yeast have, were very similar to what people had worked out in yeast. And that was significant because, you know, yeast, which are the things we make, you know, for beer and bread and stuff like that, are very divergent from us. Obviously, they're a single cell eukaryote and microscopic, and, you know, we're us, but probably a billion years apart in evolution, divergent. And yet we share very fundamental signaling pathways with yeast. And so when I cloned PAC 1994, maybe, and saw that it had an exact, you know, copy in yeast, and it was in sort of the same signaling position vis-a-vis the human cell, realized that all cells, all eukaryotic cells, fundamentally shared signaling mechanisms. And that was a pretty big deal, because prior to that, we didn't know whether signaling in us was completely different than it would be, say, in a plant or in a yeast. In fact, the odds were that it was completely different, because, you know, look how different we are from those things and how different our metabolism is and so on. And yet, at a cellular level, you know, most of it is quite familiar, and you can almost swap parts. In fact, we did that in an early experiment. We took the yeast gene and put it in human cells and vice versa, and they operated just fine. It told me that there was a real unity in signaling. And what we were studying wasn't even just about human biology. It was about biology with a big B. It was, you know, all of life was sharing these signaling pathways. So that was a kind of, I don't want to say a spiritual moment, but it was an important moment in my intellectual life. And, you know, my discovery was one of, you know, several by others around the country, around the world, that indicated that this was true, that signaling was really fundamental and old evolutionarily.
Right. Switching it up a little bit, what are like the various day-to-day roles you have? Like, what is your life look like as a researcher?
Well, it's changed lately. I became the director at Fox Chase about 4 months ago. And now, prior to that, I was a scientific director, so I already had a big administrative role, but this is even bigger yet. So my life has changed, I don't want to say for the worse, but definitely changed. I have to do a lot of institutional service now. You know, basically, my job is to clear obstacles for the scientists at our place and for the clinical folks. If they have a problem, it's my problem, you know. And before, it wasn't. When I was just running a lab, you know, I ran my lab, and that was the extent of my my duties. So now, you know, I have to come in earlier, I have to stay later, and deal with a lot of other people's problems. I mean, I understood that when I took the job, and I'm not complaining about it. It's just a fact of life. So my research activities have been scaled back to kind of quarter time. And so I have to schedule time with my lab people now. They used to just wander into my office, or I'd wander out into the lab. And I still, up until recently, still did my own experiments from time to time. So that's kind of gone by the wayside now. So it's a little bit schizophrenic, you know, since I am still running a lab and running the institution, I've got to balance those two things. And the institutional ones take up more time because it is a reasonably large number of scientists. We have 80 different labs and, you know, the hospital and clinical trials. There's just a lot of stuff to worry about. So it's a busy day, but, you know, it's always something interesting going on. That's the, you know, I'm not ever bored or lack anything to do at work. It's, if anything, I need more hours in the day.
Right. And then how did, well, obviously very unexpected when the whole pandemic started, but how did all this, all the events of the last 2 years change the way you work?
Well, you can imagine, because I'm sure it affected your life too. You know, we're a hospital, so we things like COVID restrictions were even earlier and more severe and longer lasting than in the general population. We still are masked all the time. Within the lab, that's changed in the last little while, but we were early to get vaccinated. You know, we had to go virtual in 2020 and 21 to the extent possible. But, you know, when you're running a wet lab, in other words, you're doing experiments at the bench, you can't do it completely virtual. So I did spend a lot more time at home than I'm used to on the computer doing Zooms like this, directing things, but it was a challenge. And I think we lost probably a good 6 months of productivity because we had to close down our mouse colonies. You know, we couldn't be breeding our mice or doing experiments with them. There was a lot of, you know, things that just couldn't get done. And it affected all institutions like ours, but it definitely slowed things down. We have gradually learned ways around that, what sort of things we could do and couldn't do. And it's more or less back to normal now, except that, you know, go around with the mask on, but it definitely had an impact on biomedical science.
In February of this past year, you received a $50,000 grant from the PA Breast Cancer Coalition. What are you examining with this funding?
Yeah, that was a rather unexpected. That was a project I began a few years earlier with a grant from the Department of Defense. Grant ended, we weren't done with the project yet. And then I had this opportunity with the PA Breast Cancer Coalition, and I put in an application and they fortunately funded it. So this had to do with something I've been interested in for a long time. You know, we know in breast cancer that there are certain gene amplifications that occur, and they tend to be recurrent. It's not just random. Certain chromosomes, certain regions of chromosomes, they get amplified. So instead of having one or two copies of the gene, you might end up with 20. And so there was one region on chromosome 11 that's very commonly amplified in breast cancer. And some of the genes that I've been studying my whole life were in that region. And so I was curious whether they were the important genes in that region. In other words, they were getting, when they got amplified, they were driving the cancer cells to become more malignant, or whether there might be other things in that same region that we didn't predict, but that were also contributing to cancer. So we did, I'm sure you've heard the term CRISPR, this is very popular. Now we ended up doing a CRISPR screen on every single gene in that amplicon, in that region, with like 350 genes there. So every one of them, we knocked out one by one by one, asking, did they matter to the cancer cell? Did the cancer cell stop growing if we took it out? And it turned out that we got some things we expected, but we got two genes in there that we had never even thought about, that when we knocked them out, the cancer cells really got stopped in their tracks. And both genes, although they were different, affected the same signaling process. And it was one we had not been working on before. It's something called collagen synthesis, these fibers that end up outside the cell. And so we then became convinced that these two genes working in tandem might be novel therapeutic targets, that if we could interfere with them, either by CRISPR or by drugs or whatever, we might slow down cancer growth in those cases that have amplified genes in this region. And that's about a quarter of people with breast cancer. So that's what the grant's about. It's about these two new genes that appeared that are in this amplicon that we identified by a CRISPR screen as being important. So we're now trying to validate that. The grant is only for a year, so we don't have a ton of time to do this, but we have candidates, the two genes. It's our job now to make sure that our initial screen is broadly applicable, not just in the system that we tested it in, but in others. You know, we were going back to talking about Bob Perry, you have to get multiple pillars to support whatever your hypothesis is. So we have a theory now that these genes are important, but it's only been tested in a couple of cell lines. To be stronger, we need to show that any cell line with this amplified region should be sensitive to these two genes. That's what we're working on with this grant.
Right. And then if you were to describe why all this work matters, what would you tell someone?
I would say that despite incredible strides that we've made in many types of cancer over the years, we have a long, long way to go. And, you know, I hope through work like mine or through my colleagues at Fox Chase or other institutions in the US and worldwide, we can use all the great new technologies we have, CRISPR, RNAi, gene sequencing, deep sequencing, et cetera, genetic engineering, to really get at this pernicious problem. And it's one of the number one killers, you know, in the United States is cancer. I think it's overtaken heart disease now. And we do great with certain ones, pediatric cancers, many of them are curable. Some leukemias are curable, but the vast majority of solid tumors, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, still remain very challenging if not caught early. And so our work, you know, I would like it to have an impact in people to either prevent cancer from happening in the first place, detect it very early if we can't prevent it, or cure it if we can't prevent it. So those three pillars are very important in cancer research. We tend to, my own work is in the treatment arm, not in the detection arm. But, you know, I'd like to have a difference and show patients surviving longer or not getting cancer in the first place.
What are your hopes for the future or for your legacy?
You know, it's a huge field and a hard problem. On one hand, you know, I've trained people that will take my legacy on to the next generation. And so my own trainees, the students who've gone through my lab, my postdocs, you know, they're really the future. And to the extent that I, you know, had a positive influence on them, I'll be happy about that. My own work, you know, it'll have an impact. I think it's going to be modest in the grand scheme of things. You know, I didn't cure cancer in my lifetime, but I think, you know, I was one who, you know, took some positive steps. I think the signaling pathways we identified are of interest now to many people and to the drug industry. So we've spurred them on to make good inhibitors. So I think we'll have an impact in certain cancers from my own work and in the future through my own trainees. And maybe people like yourselves who are getting, you know, excited about the possibility of joining biomedicine as you progress through your careers.
Yeah, definitely. And just to wrap our podcast up, do you have any advice for students from elementary and middle school to high school and college who want to pursue a future in medicine or scientific research?
Sure. So I think you should get exposed to science as it's really practiced. And that means, you know, getting out of the books and into a lab. And the books are great for learning fundamentals. You need some knowledge, but it's still kind of a craft and an art. And you're not going to know if you love it until you get into a lab and start doing it. And so I would advise, and there's a lot of programs like this for high school kids and also for in college, to get involved as either a volunteer or sometimes you can get paid through internships in a real research laboratory. And, you know, the range is vast. If you love computers or bioinformatic labs that, you know, do nothing but crunch numbers, and, you know, they're very valuable, but you don't have to do necessarily wet experiments. If you are into biology itself, there are tons of labs like my own that, you know, work with cells or animals. You should sample them because you're not going to know. Some people come in with great high hopes, and once they get in the lab, they just find it not to their taste, or they have to examine different types of labs to find out which ones they like. And, you know, at a young age, you have the fortune to be able to sample things without a great deal of risk. If you spend the summer doing something and it turns out not in your interest, well, you learn something valuable that this isn't a career for you, or you find that you love it so much that you want to devote your whole career to this. So you've also learned something valuable. It's almost never a neutral where you come out and say, I'm not sure about this. So I would advise, you know, contacting scientists at whatever level you can. And most people will take a dedicated volunteer if you demonstrate a real interest. You know, read some of the person's work before you talk to them so that it's clear that you've taken the time, you know, to learn what the person's about before sort of randomly sending out 100 emails. Because you can tell right away when you get these that they were just sent to a lot of people without much thought. So I would focus just on people who are doing stuff that you find interesting.
And one last question that I always like to ask, what proportion of your success through your scientific career do you think came from hard work versus how much came from just pure luck?
There were definitely some lucky things, but, you know, luck averages out over time. And so I think most of it was through hard work, some, you know, native smarts and so on, and having a good education. I mean, I think one underrated feature of being successful as a scientist is your ability to communicate. So scientists have sort of this reputation of being these nerdy people who really just talk in tech speak, who can't, you know, at a cocktail party, can't explain what it is that they do. I think that's generally just a stereotype, that people who are really successful in science, as in other fields, are great communicators. So they are able to tell what they're up to, why it's so cool, and, you know, to make it simple in a way, but while it's still a very deep and profound field. So, you know, taking a poetry class may be just as valuable as taking a biochemistry class in the long run. Because you need to be able to write, you need to be able to speak and communicate. So I would say those are highly underrated. And even telling a story, you know, when you write a paper, you have to, there's a narrative structure to it that's not so different from writing an essay for your English class. And the more you pay attention to that, the better off you are. That doesn't mean you have to shortchange, you know, knowing the chemistry, knowing the biology. You need that stuff too, but you also need to be able to communicate it.
And a huge thank you again to you for being with us today. Today we learned about Dr. Chernoff's research in oncology. Dr. Chernoff talked about the questions that drive his research, the importance of his work, and how he got interested in this subject. If you're interested in his work, you can find his research papers after just a quick Google search.
And for the Young Scientist Journal STEMZ Perspectives podcast, I'm your host, Evan Liu, alongside my co-host, Daniel Tu. Stay safe and stay curious. And thanks for listening, and keep tuned for the next episode. Thank you, guys.
Take care, guys.